Welcome to the Clinical Research Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Wolke. In this podcast, we bridge conversations between industry, thought leaders, and patients. Utilizing a unique perspective, integrating years of coaching with Tony Robbins, coupled with scientific and industry experience, we have vulnerable and real conversations with the goal of impacting the industry in meaningful ways. All right. Welcome to the podcast. Today we have Lucy Coasen at Current Health.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. So my name is Lucy Coasen. I am the head of pharma partnerships at Current Health. I have a background in biotech and have spent easily the last 10 plus years on the commercial side of life sciences. And I've got to work with customers in pharma and in academic labs, selling early stage research projects, translational research products. And then now more recently, I'm in clinical development, clinical innovation, first at Science 37, which was kind of the pioneer in decentralized clinical trials, and now at Current Health, selling our enterprise care at home platform.
Wonderful. Now, you know, the way that you and I first connected is you had commented on a podcast where people were kind of joking about decentralized trials and, you know, where is it going to be next? And someone said Best Buy, and you're like, no, it's good. Let's have a conversation. So tell me about this current, you know, this Best Buy getting into health.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it was definitely very surprising to me, and I work at Current Health, right? I don't think anybody was anticipating Best Buy acquiring Current Health, certainly not employees at Current Health. And, you know, half of our employees are UK based, so they don't even know necessarily. Best Buy is a very American and US centric brand name. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when I went to talk to customers immediately afterwards and give them the news, everyone in pharma was sort of like, Best Buy? Like Best Buy? What's Best Buy doing in healthcare? But it actually, it turns out it makes a lot of sense. So what Best Buy was seeking to do is enrich lives through technology. What Best Buy Health seeks to do is enrich and save lives through technology. And they had already, Best Buy Health specifically, they'd made a few other acquisitions in the healthcare space. And they really firmly believe that healthcare is moving out of brick and mortar facilities into the home. They are looking at, you know, aging in the home, wellness in the home, and healthcare in the home. And so for them, the Current Health acquisition just made a lot of strategic sense. And then there was a lot of cultural overlap between the two organizations as well. I think where it's really exciting from a hey, there's a totally new entity in the healthcare space perspective is Best Buy has a lot of experience in consumer electronics, right? And making products that have a great consumer experience. And this is something that we so desperately need in healthcare. In addition to that, you know, there are, 70% plus Americans live within 15 minutes of a Best Buy brick and mortar store. So I think this is a really nice opportunity, you know, similar to CVS and Walgreens getting into the trial space. It brings an actual brick and mortar store that's already in the community, brings a potential access point for healthcare products to the community. And what I think that might look like is, you know, maybe you go into, you're in the hospital for a little bit, you are discharged, you're told by your physician, hey, pick up this device that's part of our curated technologies that we use. And maybe you go to a Best Buy store to pick up that device. Or maybe you're working, you go on to Best Buy online and they have a curated marketplace set up for your healthcare provider and you order off of a list of devices that's already curated by your provider. It's connected already to our platform. And then that's already integrated with the EHR so that there's not as many steps and friction points for the actual patient. That information can flow directly from you to your care provider so that you can get better information back on how to improve your own health. And you can do this with technology and remotely. Those are the sorts of things that Current Health and Best Buy Health are looking to do in the future. But I think there's a whole bunch of other areas, right? Like I'm sure you're familiar with the Geek Squad.
Yes.
Going into the home and setting up, maybe it's your home internet or your washer dryer, whatever it might be. There's a lot of opportunity to get digital health working in the home better than it is today, and improving connectivity and making sure patients feel comfortable using devices, using in that extra layer of in-home support via the Geek Squad.
So the Geek Squad's going to go out and help patients get these devices online.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. You have it exactly correct. I mean, even explaining just basic explaining of how to use it, not from a clinical perspective. Mm-hmm. They'll get that from their provider, but from a, hey, I'm not sure how to actually use it, how to make sure it's connected, how to make sure the data is flowing properly. If it's something that requires that extra layer of support, you have the Geek Squad.
So what do you do about people that are out? You know, there's this huge push for diversity, equity, and inclusion, and reaching people. I know you said that 70% of Americans live within 15 miles of a Best Buy.
15 minutes. Yeah.
15 minutes. Yeah, I guess it depends on where it could be. New York City, 15 miles could be 3 hours within 15 minutes. So if they're within 15 minutes, what if it's someone who doesn't have reliable internet? How do you overcome that?
Yeah, that is a great point. And it's actually, so Current Health just did a customer summit last week. We had CMIOs from major health systems across the country who have implemented hospital at home programs and connectivity, and especially thinking about how do you maximize inclusivity and how do you reach those populations that don't necessarily have access to internet or don't have access to a smartphone. Our proprietary device has almost like a router where we include a SIM card, and it converts a local cell signal, the strongest cell signal available, into a Wi-Fi signal so that our continuous wearable that's meant for high acuity populations can transmit data automatically to the cloud if the individual does not have their own home internet. It also can connect to a router. But you might still be thinking, wait a minute, what if they live in an area that doesn't have a cell signal? So if someone lives in an area that doesn't have a cell signal, which is actually some of our very rural populations at in programs that, you know, Baptist Health and others might have, if they don't have a cell signal and they don't have home internet, then you really need to start thinking about, like, okay, how are you going to connect this individual? And some of the CMIOs mentioned, you know, taking really interesting strategies, including local hotspots available in the community. And one was literally like at a hay compacting site or a grain silo, in addition to the local library, as a means so that everyone in the community would know, okay, you can go to this particular place, get access to internet, and then you can access things like telehealth and telemedicine at your provider that's maybe, you know, miles and miles and miles away. But leveraging those types of tools, I think that we're looking at other technology approaches, like partnering with major telecommunications infrastructure in the US, or reducing the bandwidth required to transmit data, or satellite internet. We were actually, even somebody had brought up at this customer summit, obviously this is over drinks, the potential to leverage Starlink or technologies like that within more of a healthcare context, specifically to solve the connectivity issue.
You know, and I think you bring up some good points. I think that technology and the methodologies that we're seeing in healthcare, in clinical trials right now, are completely going to transform the landscape. And 5 years, things will look so different even than they do today. You know, as we just, it's this exponential growth with, I never in a million years, 20 years ago, would have thought that Best Buy would be in the health space. I never would have thought Walgreens and CVS, you know, and who knows who else is. What would you say is going to be the friction point of getting people to accept this idea?
So I think, well, friction point, you mean within the pharma space, or friction point for patient populations, you know, increasing participation in clinical trials past, I think, what's historically been somewhere between like 3 and 4% of the overall population?
Two great questions. Start with whichever one you choose.
Okay. I hope for the latter. You know, I actually think that COVID did something nice for the entire clinical trial industry, which is that it publicized it quite a bit more and made it a bit more human. You know, that there were moments where, you know, the US population was looking for the outcome of Moderna's trial and of Pfizer's trial because everybody needed these vaccines to come out to get back to a more normal life experience that we've been used to experiencing before. So it was nice because it actually made it, was like, hey, the trial doesn't necessarily need to be viewed as you're a guinea pig. This can be part of moving science forward and bringing cures, vaccines, improvements to human health to people faster. I think though, fundamentally, we've got a whole bunch of different technologies that have come out, everything from protocol automation to all these digital health tools to improve access and inclusivity and ease on the participant. I do think there's a bit more work that needs to be done. And this is between both pharma, I think, and patient populations that give them feedback on what is exactly the balance between what's realistic that somebody can complete and do and will make them participate and remain in a study for longer, because there's still so many steps for a lot of this stuff. And it is really, you know, a very high burden on participants and the true requirement of what's needed to get the drug approved. So I think we're seeing though a large increase at least in public awareness and in communication between those two entities. And I think there's areas where pharma is willing to bend and you know, amend protocols on things that just really don't make sense and are asking too much of patients and getting too little in return in terms of what it can actually do scientifically.
I agree. I think, you know, COVID and the trials related to getting the vaccines approved really did a tremendous benefit to the industry as a whole by even bringing the term clinical trial into the main conversations of, you know, that we were all having. You know, I used to jokingly ask people, do you know what a clinical trial is? Where the joke was, you know, trying to get my mom years ago to understand what I did. Right. I think it took like 15 years for her to understand what I did. And, you know, so I think it has been this mysterious thing, and even pharma's been vilified. And, you know, I think so it did bring into the conversation, hey, these people really are trying to help you and bring treatments and technology that can have an impact. So if we think about this, you know, as we move to decentralized trials, what is the impact on the traditional clinical site going to be, like an investigator site?
Absolutely. So I think that we're in an interesting space right now where there was a bit of over-promising and under-delivering on the part of a lot of the decentralized clinical trial companies and selling a vision where when we weren't really all the way there. And I think that it was viewed as highly disruptive, not only to some existing CROs, but also to clinical research sites. I don't know that we need to sort of swing the pendulum. Like I look at the analogy to like remote work versus being in an office, right? Like there, we had the pendulum all the way at one direction, then COVID swung it all the way to the other direction. And the true sort of happy medium for a lot of people is probably more flexibility and more options and not always one scenario or the other scenario. So what I mean by that in the clinical trial space is it doesn't make sense for most trials to be 100% decentralized and to have no participants ever going to a clinical research site at all. And certainly, good clinical research sites have a very large part to play in doing good clinical research. And I think that there are a lot of things that the industry still heavily relies on those sites for, and they're a very integral and valued part of the process. But at the same time, they have to adapt into different ways of thinking about things and using all these same digital technologies, because it doesn't make sense to go all the way back to where we started, which is things should only be at a research site, right? There has to be this happy medium Similar to like a remote work situation where it's asking the patient, you know, do you want to go into the site or would you rather do a televisit? Do you want to go when we need to do a blood draw? Do you want that blood draw at home? Do you want it at your local CVS or Walgreens? Do you want it at the site? Giving more flexibility to the patients, I think, will be the ultimate means toward inclusion and getting trials done as quickly as possible. I think if you, whether you take a solely site-based approach or a solely decentralized approach, you're always going to be leaving people out and not offering the most amount of flexibility that you can afford. And then I think there's a lot of opportunity for new technologies out there as we're giving more options to patients to make sure that we're having consistency in the results, even with all those options available.
Right. So if we were to look at, you know, the flexibility, allowing people to have the trial almost based on their terms, right? Kind of like if you think of a restaurant analogy, do you want to dine in? Do you want to take it to go? Do you want to do some
Exactly.
combination of the two? Like, what exactly are you going to do? It gives us flexibility, but as we have more people entering into the mix, almost our study teams are going to become larger because we've now got more players. How do we handle communication, making sure that everybody has the same aligned vision and we're all communicating and
That
moving?
I think is the toughest part.
How do we keep that communication piece? Because we've got all these amazing technologies designed to speed things up, to make things more accessible. But behind all of that, we've got humans. And so, how do we realize we're all on the same study team? We all have the same objectives. And really drive things forward in a collaborative way.
Yeah, I think that that's a combination of making sure you've got really nicely ironed out SOPs for all the different options, making sure that that you're keeping, you know, that those communication channels open, and that there's clear training guides and quick start guides and things like that easily accessible. Definitely, when you increase flexibility, I think you increase complexity, and when you offer more of these options, you're, as you said, increasing the size of the study team. But I think that when you look at the way the clinical trials are run right now, right, they're already extremely complex, right? You've got huge study teams. They're in 20 or 40 different countries. There's different rules and regulations that they're using all over the world. You might have some countries that are using a certain device, other countries that are on another system, because you have to make those exceptions based on what's allowed in certain, you know, jurisdictions. And so, and usually there's, you know, six plus maybe 10 different vendors already part of a study. So we already have, I think, that complication and complexity that's already part of studies. And I think that you see sort of the studies that are run the best, exactly what you're alluding to. Like, you're always going to have a lot of people, and it's how do you keep everybody communicating openly and on the same page and catch quality issues early on and address them head on, right? And it's going to require that sort of level of collaboration and commitment throughout the entire study period or you know, trial period, which is why you know, these are difficult things to pull off. It's not it's and that's one thing that I don't know that it's gotten easier with some of this technology, because now there's, you got to think about interoperability and just the number of different technologies that a single site might be using. It's a lot, right? It's a lot on any individual. So I think it's if it wasn't hard work, you know, it probably wouldn't be as rewarding.
When I think, you know, this industry typically attracts those of us who like a challenge, and it's almost like a puzzle as we piece this together and try to figure out how can we do this in a way that's going to benefit the patients ultimately. Now, you talked about all the different systems integrating together. I saw that you guys just have a new app that integrates with Epic. So that's, you know,
Yep.
designed
Big
to,
deal.
yeah, it is a big deal. Congratulations on that one. How can we simplify it if we've got, you know, I hear from clinical research sites that have seven plus logins to different systems to try to manage. How do we streamline that? I know you talked about the quick start guides and the communication, but what else can we do to make this a pleasant experience for everybody?
So The way that we see it, we are committed to building out a platform that can handle all patient populations, all levels of acuity, all therapeutic areas, and provide one source of information on the patient's health status remotely to a care team. So we not only made that very large investment in creating interoperability and being offered on the Epic App Orchard, because you know Epic EHR is something like 80% of the patients in the U.S. have a you know have are touching that EHR, so it's a very large EHR provider in the U.S. and it makes a lot of sense for a lot of our provider customers in the U.S. to be well integrated with Epic. So we've invested a bunch in that. We're also investing significantly in integrating third-party devices into our platform, once again, to improve that interoperability so that if you're a Mount Sinai or if you're a Geisinger or any, you know, health system in the United States, you don't have to have 10 different, you know, dashboards that you're logging into for all the different devices that your patients might be transmitting data from. Instead, you just have one dashboard that transmits data from all the devices, regardless of whether they're current health devices or not. And the vision and dream there is to really have everything under the sun. But of course, you know, that there's secondary issues along with that, right? Like physicians don't want to see every single step you've taken in a day on your Fitbit. They want the information that's relevant and actionable. And so, of course, we have a layer there of making sure that we're providing to them actionable information and making sure that what's actually rolling up into the EHR isn't something that's going to overwhelm the EHR and is actually actionable information and relevant to the patient's health status. So not necessarily rolling up every single Fitbit-like device that could easily be integrated with our platform. On the trial side, we are looking at interoperability with either EDCs, but also with all the other technologies that touch any clinical study. But it's definitely a challenge. You know, I feel for these sites where they don't get to select on their own that they want to use this telehealth technology. They essentially get told by some of the sponsors that, hey, you have to use technology X for running this trial because we're recording and we're keeping track of these metrics and we're doing all these other things. And so on the study, you know, use this for ECOA and use this for telehealth and use all these other things. It can make it very challenging for them. So I think one part of that might be at one point, do some of the sponsors say, you know, if there's already a telehealth or other system working really well at that site, maybe not, you know, maybe it's not up to the trial to change it. But I think that that's something that's going to be a back and forth between sponsors and sites. And I think right now the sponsors always will have more control.
Well, and a lot of times the sponsors will send that over to the CRO and the CRO chooses a system. What we see a lot is the CROs use their system and then that data coming back to the sponsor's like, we don't understand the system. What do we do with it? How do we put it in a system? Even if we just need to archive it so that we can have it, you know, for the agencies and be able to maintain it long-term. So that we see a lot of, we also see a lot of sites, you know, just the frustration with the multiple systems and making sure that everything is integrated. What would you say is important, Lucy, as we step into this next phase?
Let's see, what's important for the next phase? I think a few things. I think we have to think about, you know, interoperability isn't going anywhere in terms of being probably one of the biggest challenges across the board in healthcare. I think connectivity is going to be something that any digital health tool provider, whether in a clinical trial context or in a commercial care context, has to think about. And I think one of the other things is the continued trend for consumerization in healthcare and thinking about how you can better empower patients and better give patients better tools and capabilities to manage their own care and stay adherent on treatment regimens and be successful in getting to the state of health that they're looking to get to.
I agree. I think, you know, we do have these issues of, there's also something really valuable, I think, with this consumerization of patient health. Patients then are responsible for their own health, and they then can have, you know, the freedom to make whatever health decisions are best for them. You know, hopefully we'll see, you know, there's that big issue too, as far as clinical research as a care option, and making that accessible to some of those more diverse populations that maybe never even knew what a clinical trial was, or that it might be an option if someone doesn't have adequate healthcare access. So I think that that is something that kind of feeds into that too. What would you say, you know, a lot of times I hear people, they reach out and they say, I want to get into this industry. How do I get into it? Because they really, there's so many different layers to it and things to understand. So what would you say to someone who wants to kind of learn more about where is the industry going, and what do we need to look out for?
So this is funny. I actually, a friend of mine who's at Google just reached out and was like, I want to get involved in this industry. And she's like, I have all this experience in AI. And are there applications for AI in your industry? Of course there are. There's tons. I think that there's several AI startups, not only, you know, predictive analytics for sensors, but also using AI to design a better trial, things like that. So I think that the industry always needs more talent and more experience coming in from other industries that are not related. It is certainly, though, difficult to learn from the ground up. I think I can say this. I was in, you know, more biotech beforehand, like tools and technologies in earlier stage research and translational research. And when I started at Science 37, that was really my first experience being on the clinical trial side and seeing kind of what the entire process was like at all. And it's not like there's a handbook anywhere, although there are some tools that I've discovered more recently out there on the web. The Digital Medicine Society, for example, has one really nice clinical trial tool and informational set. But yeah, it's definitely a learning curve, right? So there's not, it's difficult to know all these components of everything that is already in place from how studies were run, you know, over the last like 20, 40 years, and how all these different tools, everything from, you know, paper pros to now e-pros and electronic data capture and randomization, IRT, and what that looks like, and all the different rules, and how everything is regulated in an IRB, how it all sort of fits together. But I think if you're somebody who enjoys learning and is excited by a challenge, then this is a great space to be in.
Now let's take the flip side of that is for somebody who's been in the industry for 25, 30 years. And is, you know, when I started, there were like three part NCR forms that we'd separated a site and FedEx in. How do you get people that have been around for a while to adopt the new technology and to embrace it?
That's sort of what I think about, like throughout my entire career, is when you have something that's new and innovative, how do you get, because there's always a risk, right, in adopting any innovation. Like, what if it doesn't work? Or, you know, when decentralized clinical trials were sort of becoming all the rage, Pfizer was really early on in picking it up and adopting it. But I think most other companies were kind of wanting to see somebody else be the guinea pig. They were like wanting another entity to go through the clinical trial and not them. And then everything sort of became accelerated by COVID. But even in the midst of COVID, it was still very unclear how the FDA and other, you know, health authorities and regulatory agencies were going to regulate that process. And if they were essentially doing clinical development that was going to have to be redone because they didn't do it in this specific right way. And I think some of those fears have been sort of have come down a bit, because I think that regulatory authorities have tried to step up and say, okay, there are actually other ways to do this, and the data you can get at home and not necessarily at a research site is of as high quality, sometimes even higher quality than at a research site. So I think it's all about finding the people who are technology adopters first and are willing to take that risk, because they know that taking those risks and innovating fastest have the highest reward across the entire spectrum. So it's identifying those entities and then sort of getting everybody else to come along after they see the data or they see more information. It convinces them that, okay, this is actually safe enough for me.
Yeah. I agree. I think that, I think that COVID did a lot of that. It showed us new paradigms that worked. It showed the agencies new paradigms that worked as well. So I think it gave everybody that assurance, like, okay, some of this can work. This is great. I appreciate you, Lucy, and I appreciate you taking time to chat and to share your thoughts. Anything else you want to leave our listeners with?
I think we're in an economic environment right now that's really rocky, and everyone's a bit, you know, fearful of what's happening over the next few years or months. But I think that there was such, you know, excitement over the paradigm shift that occurred during COVID. And I think the most exciting part was that people just did something different and tried something new and changed how they normally thought about challenges. And we really need to hold on to a lot of that to have the same amount of innovation and acceleration of getting things done in the future. Like, we cannot let that urgency go, because there still are, you know, I think about what's happening in oncology, and I think about a lot of these rare diseases, and I think about other areas where patients really need medical progress. And we can't lose that urgency, even if we're sort of scared of the macro environment, or sorry, the macroeconomic environment.
Yeah, no, I think
because,
that's,
yeah.
Yeah, no, I was just saying, I think that Simon Sinek says, you know, remember the why. So it comes down to that why.
Yes.
And having a big enough why that you're willing to do it regardless.
Exactly. Yeah, we can't lose the urgency.
No. Oh my goodness. So good. Thank you, Lucy. I appreciate you, and best of luck as you continue to trailblaze.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Clinical Research Coach. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you'd subscribe and leave a rating and a review. I truly hope that you got something out of this episode that can help us all work towards our goal of making a meaningful difference in the lives of others.